The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Tuesday, the 24th of December, 2019. On the podcast today, I have James Draper, Chief Executive Officer of Bidstack, BIDS, and James discusses their recent trading update and the milestone advertising trading agreement. Also on the podcast, Dr. Dan Gooding, CEO of Nuformix, and Dan talks about the highlights from their interim results and gives an insight into what the company is hoping to achieve in 2020. Plus, Nick Lee, Investment Director at Riverfort Global Opportunities, RGO ticker there, Nick explains why they have requisitioned the directors of Plutus Power Gen to call a general meeting. I also have, on this Christmas Eve, top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is James Draper, CEO of Bidstack, BIDS ticker. James, thanks for joining me.
Absolute pleasure, Justin. Good to be back on.
Yeah, well, lots of people have said to me, I've had lots of people saying to me, get James on the podcast. I want clarification of this or that, or tell him to talk about this and that. So I know lots of people will be glad you're coming on. And so last three bits of news, really, I want to cover. And it starts off on the 18th of December. You did a trading update, which saw the share price fall by around, I think, 40% at one point. Take us through the trading update, because obviously you confirmed that you're going to sort of miss some targets that are in the market. Take us through that, if you could, James.
Well, last week was quite challenging, I think, it's fair to say. So, probably it all links in, but in short, there's been... The trading update came out on the day it did, down to the fact that on that day it became quite clear that we were not going to be able to recognise the 5.9 that was out in the marketplace in terms of revenue for this year. I'll come on to the details of the deal which we've done, which came out the following day, a little bit sort of later on into this. I'm sure you've got separate questions to do with that, so I'll answer as much as I'm allowed to do that, but I've got to respect our partner on that, and it's not something which I can expand upon too much. But it's fair to say, this company, if I look at where it was a year ago to where it is today, the amount of progress we've made, and if you sort of look through the announcements that we made, both formally and a little bit more informally, with regards to the type of characters that have got themselves involved with the Bidstack journey, and the quality of the advisors, and we've alluded to some of the technical challenges that the business has had to overcome over the last year. The amount of progress I looked from 12 months ago to now is unbelievable in terms of the infrastructure within the company. We've got some clear, very strong individuals that have sort of come to the fore, some like leadership personalities. We've got a very strong developer base that's been built out in Riga. Maritza's done a fantastic job, product lead who joined from King, done a fantastic job of building out that team over the course of the year. And our lead developers over there have just done a remarkable job of forming that group. And if I look and see what we've managed to achieve in such a sort of short period of time, where now the technology is fully operational end to end. You can go on to the trade desk and buy our inventory now, in particularly what we know as a private marketplace deal. So you can run your campaign programmatically and report back to your client if you're an agency in a way which you would do if you're buying web-based inventory, for example. And that's been an enormous task for us to get ahead around, to work out precisely what is required. And I think I mentioned it a few times, there's no off-the-shelf solution for this. Our partners that we're working with, like the trade desk, for example, have to work out how to fit our inventory onto their user interface, how it could work, how it can report back, how their system sees what we're reporting back on. It's been an incredible year from that standpoint. Now, if I look from the commercial aspect, and obviously which triggered the trading update, there's certain things which over the course of the year we've been working on with some really interesting partners. When I say interesting, I mean very large scale companies that are, I would say, are household names that we are rather close to. But these type of businesses aren't on AIM. We are very small compared to the other partners that they might be working with. And as such, there are certain things which we can disclose, there's things we can't disclose at this time. Some of them are working partnerships outside of a contractual arrangement. Some, obviously, when things go into full contracted form, then obviously we have an obligation to inform the market on it. So from a, if you look at the supply side of the business, for example, which we mean by the games in which we've onboarded, there's some really interesting things which we're doing on that side, and I think it's fair to say that we've learned so much with our good friends over at Sports Interactive, who are just based in the next building to us, and that's part of the reason why we're based where we are. And Codemasters, well, have given us an extremely interesting two case studies for us to sort of work off back of. One which is a stadium-based game, and one which is a circuit-based game, circuit-based games. So with that in mind, trying to define and trying to report back on some basic things such as what is an advert impression, what is an impression in a racing game environment compared to a stadium-based environment. Now, it's a lot more complicated than it would initially appear because you've got to be able to report back to the trading software like the Trade Desk or whatever it might be, the programmatic buying platforms. And the way in which that has to be done, it's quite a complicated process. I won't go into too much detail on it because I know some of our competitors listen to this, but and they will have their own theories on how to do it, but it's not standardized. There's no standardized way in which that is completed at the moment. So we spent a lot of the year sort of working with our partners on making sure that process is as seamless as possible. Now, we've managed to get to the point where that is 100% fluent from one side to the other. So our SDK is embedded into these gaming environments and it's reported back all the right cues that the likes of the Trade Desk have wanted to see, mm-hmm. which has made it very easy for agencies now to run test spends through us, which we've sort of been building up over the course of the year. First half of the year was really sort of absolutely embryonic test spends, and it's sort of gone just getting there, getting more and more people used to this type of inventory. What it is when it appears on their trading software, what is this inventory which is flashing up as in-game, what is that? So we've got to that point, which is great. But then the discussions which we've had with the game publishers, crucially, not one game publisher has told us to go away. We're in conversations with everyone you would expect us to be in conversation with. But it's also sort of worth stating on top of that, we're so early in the value add cycle to these guys, when they're even on a free to play game, where the microtransactions make up the majority of their revenue. We've got to educate them and educate their studio on a number of levels. We've got to educate them on the value we'll add in terms of the potential revenue side of this new ad format. And some of them were around 10 years ago when they saw what happened with Massive, IGA and Double Fusion. And that can work sometimes in our favor and sometimes against us, mm-hmm. In terms of people have been around something which had a lot of hype around it and it didn't quite get there because it was just a little bit too early. So we have to engage the studios, get them excited about where the advertising market's come to in the last 10 years and why people want to buy their inventory. Then it's a case of like building out the common trust in terms of we're not going to come along and wreck your artwork and start chucking in web banner adverts into high fidelity environments and destroy the artwork that you've got 200, 300 designers creating in the large business, in the large game creators studios. And then it's a case of starting testing our technology within their test environments, their QA testing, etc. Now, you can imagine that that's been done, and we know, for example, certain competitors of ours who are well known have been removed from tech stacks in favour of bid stacks technology within certain testing environments. So that's given everyone here a big boost. But you can't force these guys to make us jump the queue. There might be certain things. There might be certain game studios, game publishers that themselves might have had to put out adjustments to their market that they operate on, for example. And obviously, it then puts an awful lot of pressure on them just to get their product out in any form, or for it to be put out in a focusing all developer resource on initial launch on the actual sort of core gaming product. Because we're so early, and we basically are like a startup in this particular sort of space, because it's a net new ad category, it takes an awful long time to make sure that you're telling these studios, right, we need to go in by this date. Luckily, we've got some interesting things which are now coming to fruition. Can't talk about it, and people will believe me or not believe me. That's entirely your choice. But there's some very, very interesting developments that are going on, which set the company up very well for next year. And in terms of where I can see the company going over the next sort of 12 months from now, where I would like to see the business, there's a number of additional things, but in terms of the sort of core native proposition, there's a real heap of evidence that the ad category native in-game advertising will be fully formed by that stage. I think it's an ambition for us to have this inventory on open exchange by the end of sort of Q3, Q4 next year would be achievable. And from that stage, that's when the real money starts pumping through this industry. And that's when it's extremely exciting for us. But it's fair to say that the advisors which we brought on at the start of the year, and we've added two, and Brian and I have been the last one which we announced. There are others as well who we're associated with that, for various different reasons, we can't openly talk about them because they're more useful being under the radar for us. So, yeah, it's the company's in a good position. The frustrating thing is that there's a couple of things which happened over the course of the year. There's one thing which I'll tell you guys now as well. There was some, before our interims went out, there was some M&A activity. And I have to be very careful about how I talk about this, but there was some M&A activity that was going on at that time that was a very large deal that was very exciting for the company. But due to the slide in share price, it no longer made sense for that deal to continue. But it's fair to say that it left us exposed just before the interims came out. Less than a week before the interims came out, we were left quite exposed by it, annoyingly. So we put together hurried, and it's a trouble with the market. Obviously, we're on. We want to ensure that our investors see the constant progress which we are making here. There's certain deals which we'd like to spend a bit more time on, but we potentially sort of speed up just to make sure that markets appease. So you saw the strategic partnership which we announced with Dentsu Aegis just before the interims came out, and that was probably slightly faster put together than we would have ideally liked, but we didn't want the market to be confused about the fact that we were releasing low numbers, and it's been a very interesting learning experience this last particularly last sort of 3 to 6 months. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I say the company is in a really interesting position. Let me talk. I'll talk to you about the trade deal if you want to ask me any questions to do with that.
Yeah, just on that, before we get that, the trading update. So you mentioned there that these the revenues are delayed, so they're not sort of cancelled. Are you hoping that these the target figures you had for this year now will be rolled over into next year?
Well, we disclosed the amount of the deal, right? So yes, but it's a we were operating on two deals at the same time. There were two deals running in tandem. One which we could recognize, and one deal which would be purely a 2020 recognized deal. Mm-hmm. Now these things are extremely complicated, and certain, I can't say who it is, but there's certain forces within these companies and certain committees which this type of spend has to go through, and there's a certain way in which they have to go around their various different markets and get comfort around the potential buy-in from various different territories on this new inventory, and to go out to their clients and talk to their clients and get a bit of a feel for what type of spend value they would be interested in putting into this type of new inventory. So they're very, very complex deals, and there's different ways in which you can recognize this type of deal as well. There was, for example, you could do like a deal which is upfront committed. There are deals which you can do which they're buying access to certain, we can sell them access to certain points of our systems and inventory. And then there are deals which are like pure media spend deals, which obviously by AIM rules are not recognisable. It's fair to say that on the day in which we announced the trading update, it became clear late at night the previous day that we were put into a situation where it was quite apparent we weren't going to be able to recognise the first deal. That was not going to make much sense. It was not going to be signable from either side. So we reverted to the second deal, which we were going to spend a bit more time on and get over line in early January. We put a lot of pressure on over the next 24 hours to sort of expedite a couple of the decision making processes for that. So that the reason there was a gap between is that there was plan, let's call it plan A, was apparent that it wasn't going to be recognisable this year. We weren't going to get the deal done in a way which we both sides would be happy with. So, for the interest of the long term health of the company, that deal did not come to a conclusion. So, as we are bound by the AIM rules, we had to announce the next day with haste. Ideally, obviously, it would be far nicer for us to have put them both together. But it's sadly was not possible for us to do so. We would have been, you know, hand and heart would have been in a suspect place if we'd done that. So it was rush, 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 and then we managed to get the deal signed late the next day to be able to get it to get that one announceable for the following morning. So
yeah, and that was so the share price on the trading update went down about 40%. Then on this, at one point, it went by 50 odd percent. So the milestone advertising trading agreement that was. Now, in that, I understand you probably can't talk a lot about it because, like I said, you haven't revealed that in the RNS, but you can't name the company, I assume. But you've got a gross media expenditure of up to 10 million per annum for the next 2 years. Now, how does that work? I mean, because you set up to now, like I said, that could be £1,000, it could be 10 million. So, how do you have you any idea how much is that going to generate? And if so, how does it work? Is it revenue split? Is it commission? How does that work?
Well, I have an idea of what it will generate. The way it works, you have to get a trading framework in place with these agency groups to get some big spends out of them. To move beyond the test spends, you have to get a trading agreement in place. Once you've got that trading agreement in place as a media owner, which we are, then the agency group is far more comfortable in spending more money with you for various different reasons. So I have some visibility over what agency X is looking to do and spend, and what type of clients might be interested in what we're doing. As I say, it's been many months of warming up markets and warming up clients. We have a rough idea of who wants to spend what. I won't disclose who they are and what they'd be willing to spend, obviously. But it's the way it works is that it's agreed spend. I'm trying to work my words carefully. It's agreed spend, gross spend that will be spent on our customers, and our customers being the game publishers' inventory. Now that will be obviously there'll be a revenue split within there as well, which we can't disclose as well between us and our game partners. But it's the agreed spend coming out from the agency on our inventory. So that's it in a nutshell.
Okay, so that 10 million, for example, is split between who altogether? Split between the media agency, yourself, and the publishers, game publishers?
Correct. Not the media agency. The media agency is spending it with us.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah. And like I said, a lot of people said, I saw on Twitter saying, this is quite a vague RNS because they couldn't work out, you know. First of all, the share price went real up, 10 million, because people saw the figure 10 million. Then people thought, hang on, it's up to 10 million. Well, that could be zero. Or, you know, so it's hard to say. Obviously, you don't know yourself, or you have an idea. But it's, you know, that's why people are confused by it. Say, why up to 10 million? Why, you know, and I suggest, well, if they said, you know, nothing less than 1 million, that'd be quite good. But, you know, it's just hard to people to get an angle on how much you're getting from this. You understand?
The thing is, outside of some very, let's say, for example, Plan A was an agreed level of spend that was committed, and also came with some other bits and pieces within it that made it recognisable. The secondary piece is a slightly different deal structure. However, this is how most trade agreements are agreed within the media landscape. So anyone who's listening who's done a trade agreement before, this is how they are done. On the most part, this is how they are worded on the most part. So it's fair to say that both parties are incentivized to get more out of the deal and work deeper and closer together. But I can't say more than that. Okay. But it's fair to say that with these type of agreements, the way they're structured normally, it makes sense for both parties to hit the higher numbers if it makes sense for their clients as well. And it's got to make sense for their clients. So if our inventory makes sense for their clients, then I'm saying through the various different things which we did over the last few months, we know what brands are interested in what we're doing, what indicative amounts they would be prepared to invest in this type of inventory. And you know, we're very, very excited about that. And I think it's fair to say that the way this company is going, the way this company could get to, it has a number of routes to victory that we could look at. Now, obviously, from my point of view, the company has technically had an exit by us going to go and doing a reverse takeover. Obviously, I'm incentivized for my shares to be worth as much as possible, obviously, and there's basically ways we could grow this company out on AIM in the future. There are also certain ways in which certain things that are you could argue over in terms of who would be interested in this type of company. Why would they be interested in this type of company? What is it in this company that would excite certain people to potentially, I don't know, just talking speculatively, and in no way, you know, this is pure sort of just me sort of saying that just give people a landscape of what success could look like down the track. It's taking our technology, maybe taking some of our supply or whatever else we might have under contract and plugging it into their ecosystem, and they can make more of it than we can do on our own. Now, that doesn't necessarily equate to what the Peterhouse research, which they're good guys, you know, they tried their best with the information that we gave them at the time. It's fair to say that, you know, our understanding of the market is far, far greater now than it was back then. far, far greater from all angles. So it's what I think we've got a responsibility of as a company in early January. I think we need to go and give the market some clear idea of the routes to victory this company can have. Mm-hmm. Yes, we're at the start of what is it, technically a new industry, like a new ad category, a new industry. There's loads of it, very exciting things going on that there's nothing that has come to a final stop. It's just things have just been pushed into 2020. So from a point of view of where this company can get to, remarkably excited. What we want success to look like, I think we probably need to sort of just to give a slightly better guidance of what that success could look like to certain people, what to look for, what waypoints people should be looking at, because it's fair to say that the type of advisors, for example, we've got around the company are, I would say, there's not many companies on AIM that have got that caliber of person that have been happy to associate themselves with a business, especially one that's a micro cap. They haven't got involved just randomly. They have a fair idea of what we're up to and where we're trying to get to, and have a feel for how they can contribute towards that. We've got some absolute whales associated with the business now, which is excellent. And it's fair to say that there are a number of things that will be putting in place over Q1 that I think we'll see the company in a very, very strong position over the course of the year. So, yeah, very excited. All good, and it's been a fun few months in particular.
Yeah. And that plan A you said, is that still there? Is that still available? Because can that still happen?
Absolutely. Okay. Yep.
All right.
Yeah. As I say, nothing's come to a final conclusion. It's just we're beholden of, and I have to be very, very careful with this, because we haven't always got the full control. There might be certain things going on within our partners or potential partners' companies that just delay things slightly. I alluded to it with the gain side. It could be the same thing with the demand side. So it might be things which just make things just push back a little bit. Don't come to a final full stop. Just get pushed back a little bit. And we have to respect these guys. We're looking to build out long-term relationships with these people. We like them as human beings. We like the way in which we could both benefit from each other's existences. And what we don't want to do is put undue pressure on relationships that are very much embryonic. That feels like the definition of what losing looks like. So we've got to make sure that my thing is obviously is to take some of the criticism now. That's absolutely fine in exchange for the benefit of the company, our staff, our partners, what we're doing in the longer term. Because I think that's far more important than short-term sentiment.
Yeah. And as far as, like I said, the potential here is concerned, I've said this company's still got huge potential. Obviously, the share price goes up and down. Because, like you say, you are quite cutting edge, and that will happen. In tech companies, that will happen. But I mean, is the future as bright as you thought it was going to be, or are there bigger challenges now? I mean, what is the biggest challenge now? But do you still see the future as bright?
I think it's brighter than even we thought at the start. There's so many routes that we can go down with this business. It's the trouble is, I'll give you an example. I won't name the company, but the trouble is, I've alluded to it. It's the challenge and the frustrating thing from my side is that I know, obviously, I get full visibility of all the things going on through the business. And I know it must be extremely frustrating for certain people who are doing their day trades or whatever they might be doing, their sort of medium-term holdings. And, it's their own money. I completely respect that people need to fully, and they should, look after themselves first and foremost. However, the fluctuation in share price can be frustrating because we can be in a conversation, for example, with an extremely exciting potential partner, and obviously they had a quick look of us online, and and it raised question marks on what's going on, which we then have to cover off and explain the volatilities of the market which we're on, and our communication strategy, and why that might have led to people losing a bit of confidence. There's absolutely no change in terms of our ambitions to where this company can get to. Now, because our knowledge level has gone up so much, and because we've added some really high quality individuals into the business, and because we've doing a good job with even in testing environments with certain people, the word has spread of what we have and what it could be, particularly stateside, that the potential routes to victory are vast. I'm extremely bullish towards it in terms of where I think the business needs probably to inform our investors better on. We've got to be careful as well. It's a real sort of challenge for me, is I've got to try and balance updating you guys on what is going on so people retain the confidence and understand what is happening, whilst at the same time, obviously having to stick by the AIM regulations when I can communicate and what I can communicate. But on top of that, it's being aware that we've got competitors out there. They're listening to this. They'll listen to this podcast now. Why wouldn't they? So it's a free bit of research for them. So I've got to really temper what I can tell you, what I'm willing to have in the hands of our competitors, respecting the type of NDAs which we're under, respecting the rules of AIM as well. It's trying to sort of balance it all. But in terms of the general picture of the health of the business from within these walls here, and our walls have been, our offices in Riga and the States, really, really strong, really huge amounts of interest in what we're doing. But it's our biggest challenge, going back to our biggest challenge, it's time. It's time. It's making sure that it's a responsibility of me to make sure that our teams have the time and the resources to be able to execute on what is a very complicated and net new and very embryonic ad category industry. And it's the win is there. The win is large. The win is there's no this stops play thing ahead of us. We're doing some interesting patents, for example, at the moment, which we won't discuss here, obviously, but it links towards where this future of this company can go. We've got some extremely bright people around us who have seen some interesting nuances within this space. And if people were able to see John Malkovich style through my eyes for the last few months, they would be far more excited than they appear on certain bulletin boards. So yes, it's extremely intriguing. I think also, just say I won't give any airtime to certain sort of individuals, but you can imagine there might be certain individuals out there who are commentators, they phrase themselves as, that talk a lot of nonsense and may or may not be incentivized to try and get our price lower. So all fun and games. It's been a hell of an experience seeing all this play out. But in terms of the future of the business, it is in a good place. We've got some very good things going on. We've got some very good people here. So yes, it's all rosy, my friend.
Cool. One last question, and I wanted you to, because the confirmation regarding trading updates, a clarification RNS that came out on the 20th, confused me. I mean, I know it's not supposed to do that, but it mentioned a couple of things, and it says the company's revenues in 2019-2020 contained in its trading update announced. So it mentioned that, basically, I don't understand it, but does it, and in your trading update you say the board is pleased with recent progress and expects that its industry relationships will deliver a material uplift in revenues in 2020. Now, is that clarification just clarifying that, or was it saying it won't be as good in 2020? It confused me. What was it saying?
Not the latter. Okay. It's not saying that there's any negativity towards our potential for 2020 at all. The, okay. the, it's It's definitely fair to say that the outlook for 2020 is very strong from a commercial standpoint. So, yes, it's fair to say.
2019, fair enough, has been impacted because of that missed deadline on that Plan A. But 2020 is still looking intact, and that will be sort of hopefully rolled over into that year, into next year. Is that right?
Not intact, looking probably better than we could have thought in certain ways. So I say what I want to do is give some update on some guidance surrounding waypoints that people should look out for over the course of next year. But in terms of revenue opportunity, it's only going to get easier for us from next year. This trade agreement is significant, and it is a milestone for this industry. It's the first time that there has been a proper trade agreement put in place like this, and it's just the first of many that we will be doing with multiple agency groups that we are very much in communications with, and they'll, from there you can imagine that there's a very interesting set of commercial opportunities that we've got ahead of us that we will hopefully be able to start talking about in Q1, maybe Q2 next year. But there's some really interesting routes that are becoming more and more apparent as we're getting deeper and deeper relationships with both the demand and supply sides, and who's particularly showing from a technical point of view interest in what we're up to from all over the world.
Marvellous stuff. Okay, well, James, that was a lot of stuff and a lot of content. I'm going to ask you to summarise that in 3 points. And if you can, so keep it short, but if someone's listening right now and they thought they missed the opportunity first time around because the share price went crazy when people saw the potential, but it's come back now. If people have missed out, but they, you know, like the progress you're making and like what you're saying here, give them 3 quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
I'd say that the trade agreement which we've announced is extremely good news for the company and the new ad category as a whole. It's a very good thing for us. The company is in very good health in terms of where the company is sat within the business. And it's also fair to say that given the amount of learnings that we've had over the course of this year, I would say that the company is in a very, very strong position in terms of the way in which we are set up infrastructure-wise going into 2020, where commercially we should be able to capitalise on that.
Marvellous stuff. James, thanks for coming on, and I wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, and hopefully we'll catch up in 2020. Thanks a lot.
Cheers, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Dr. Dan Gooding, CEO of Nuformix. That's NFX ticker. Dan, happy Christmas.
Happy Christmas as well, Justin. How are you doing?
Yeah, not too bad. Just around the corner. But you're still working there. It's good to see. You know, half a trading day today, but you've released your unaudited half-year results of the 6 months ended the 30th of September. And there's a lot going on. And I did tweet out today saying you've got a lot going on here. You've done a lot this year. And we'll dig into the highlights. But before we do, as always, Dan, for someone, you know, not familiar with Nuformix, say new to the podcast, or I've never heard of you before, just summarise what you're about, if you could, please.
Yeah, of course. So Nuformix is a drug development company. What we mean is that we're developing a range of drug programs up to a point of proof of concept. And having achieved those proof of concepts, we'll then look to out-license those assets to drug companies who take them to market. So it's a development business with a licensing business model. But what makes us slightly different is that we develop programs based on known drugs.
Yeah.
So we like known drugs because they're safe. We can move them faster to inflection point. We can get into clinical studies faster. And this whole process represents less risk than you'd usually associate with traditional models. And we have a technology platform which allows us to do that in a unique way called co-crystal technology. And that allows us to do new things with known drugs that weren't previously possible and patent those improvements with very robust new patents.
Yeah. Do you know what I'm surprised at? When you see pharmaceutical companies, especially new coming to the market and in R&D stage, you normally see cash burn very high. And you're talking about in millions, even tens of millions can be sometimes, you know. I looked at your loss for the 6 months. That's 130 grand. That's phenomenal amount of, I mean, that is low cost, isn't it?
Well, it is, and I think also the majority of that is a large chunk of that is sort of share based costs as well. So, you know, we're pretty much at a break even point, sort of spending what we're making. We're able to do this in two ways. We have very low operational costs. Also, you know, we've been able to achieve this result in a period where we've just conducted our first clinical trial. Those first clinical studies for us that validate our technology, they're usually relatively short, less risky kind of studies that simply validate our technology, and therefore they don't have a lot of the higher costs that you'd associate with developing, say, a completely new drug. That's when you see, you know, very large costs, and also when you get into very large numbers of patients, and it's very unlikely that new formats will ever do those kind of things either. So the business has got a low operating cost model, and it will retain that low operating cost model as well.
Yeah. And I did tweet out there, I said this. You know, like I say, this year now you've got four active programs going on and offshoots from those as well. You've got two sort of commercial agreements in place, and news on any one of these could be quite significant. I mean, take us through. Let's start with NXP1 because, of course, we're still waiting on a payment from the guys in China. What's going on there?
Yeah, that's right. So we completed a study. A pilot bioequivalent study for a product that goes into the oncology supportive care space. So we had a successful result of that study. We've been waiting to receive payment from our license partner for the completion of that study. And that's just been a little bit delayed. So what's happening there is that there are a number of activities that we would like to continue with New Summit, and we're just negotiating exactly what that wider package of activities is going to look like. And I'm hopeful that we will have all of that resolved before Chinese New Year.
Okay, for people not aware of that, when is Chinese New Year?
That's just towards the end of January.
Oh, okay, so that's not far off. That's good. I know, you know, time. It's always hard to put sort of, you know, a hard stop date on it because these kind of things always slip. But that's good. That's not too far away. So that payment, hopefully,
that's not too far away.
So, yeah, that's good.
Also, in that, you know, that oncology supportive care program, we're also in discussions with a larger generics company with global reach. We're in sort of early stage discussions for, you know, looking at that asset and potentially developing it in partnership with those guys, potentially into lung cancer cough as well. So that's where that first program is. Awaiting a payment from a licensed partner, but also having an opportunity to work with a global partner with this product and take it potentially into numerous indications.
Okay, cool. Let's go to NXP2 then. Of course, there was that leak. Some news from suggestions of obviously Japan, some tie up with a partner in Japan there. What's happening there?
Yeah, of course. So NXP2, this is our treatment for idiopathic lung fibrosis, pulmonary fibrosis. This is, for me, you know, one of the outstanding programs within the business. We've got a real opportunity to take quite an innovative approach to how we treat this really life-threatening disease. And we are in relatively advanced discussions with a number of Japanese licensed partners. This is a Japanese drug. and one of those in particular discussions are relatively advanced and is also our preferred partner. So we're very hopeful that certainly early in 2020, we can bring this negotiation to a conclusion and then announce exactly the terms of that transaction and its meaning for the program as we look to accelerate that forward. Now, we've also announced just very recently that's going to be an inhaled treatment, which is quite a lot of benefits in terms of how that will become more commercially attractive to licensees.
Yeah. And when you say early, are we talking first quarter, first half, or did you know?
Yeah, I'd like to think that, you know, this will be brought to a conclusion within the first quarter, and that'll be the final quarter for our financial year, and really put the icing on the cake of that complete 2020 financial year for us. I'm really hopeful that those two events for NXP1 and NXP2 will be resolved in that period.
Wow. Okay. So, a news-rich, first month and first quarter. All right. So, moving on to EBAs, the cannabinoid development agreement. What's the progress there, Dan?
So the progress that activity remains on track. There, we're looking at putting some of the benefits of co-crystal technology into the cannabinoids, which are obviously a very attractive set of molecules. We've filed our first patent, and as a result of the activity, which is ongoing here within the lab, so we'll see further announcements in relation to milestones as the existing co-crystals that we've developed so far now go on further and achieve other milestones, and as new ones come in behind it. And I think that still remains the focus of that activity, locking down a range of intellectual property on novel forms of exciting cannabinoids.
Yeah, excellent stuff. And of course, we've heard you first mention recently NXP4 has entered into the pipeline.
That's right. So we have, as well as the activity ongoing here on sort of discovering new co-crystals of cannabinoids, we have an ongoing activity using our platform to discover new small molecule co-crystals as well. And we've plucked NXP4 out of that activity. It looks like a standout opportunity, which we really want to capitalize on. There's some applications there within the oncology, but also, again, within the sort of fibrosis space. And this is really, again, us thinking about, you know, how we really want to build our pipeline, trying to keep things within therapeutic areas of interest. So staying around sort of fibrosis, for example, and beginning to develop a small number of programs will position the company well, ultimately, hopefully, for a trade sale purpose once we've taken at least one of those fibrosis assets through a serious value inflection point, which will most likely be a small patient proof of concept study. So that's with the view in terms of how the portfolio is being built and taken forward.
Yeah, well, do you know what? I think it's quite remarkable that this active, you have four, like I said, you know, programs now. Two, you know, one definitely commercial. Second one, of course, you're getting towards a commercial signing, and your EBIT there as well. And yet, you've done all this on such low cost base. I think it's quite remarkable, really. It's quite an achievement, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's something that we always thought we could do. Working on known drugs means that we can reuse a lot of existing safety data. We don't need to regenerate a lot of that data ourselves. Yeah. Some of that can take quite a lot of time and also cost quite a bit. So also we're very hopeful that any Japanese partner that we sign with will also be able to bring that to the table in terms of NXP2, bring that data and help us really accelerate through the gears in terms of taking that asset forward into the clinic as well. So I think, you know, really it just validates the approach that we're taking. The numbers speak for themselves, the things that we've done in the period. That's certainly a model that we hope to retain going forwards as well.
Yeah, and I know, you know, like I said, it's been on the... There's a lot of excitement around Nuformix, and you know, whenever I sort of share anything on social media, it gets a decent amount of traction because I think people see the potential, that there's, you know, a big potential here compared to where you are at the moment, the valuation you're at the moment, and the only thing that's, you know, that's holding it back is news. But now, like you say, we are going into a period here where we'll see that news, you know, being released hopefully, and so you must be feel quite excited as to where you are at the moment, are you?
Oh, massively, yeah. I think this, for me personally, this has been, you know, probably looking forward now. This is the most exciting opportunity I think we've ever had within the business. I think we've got an opportunity to close a transaction here that will propel this program of ours forward, into the clinic, into patients, and you know, that is just an incredibly exciting opportunity. And then to be able to build around that in terms of other pieces of value, and see, you know, what we can do in terms of, you know, really building critical mass within the portfolio, with a view to, you know, knowing really that a company like ours, you know, it's very difficult to, you know, particularly when you're looking at the idea of going into sort of phase threes in the disease areas in which we're targeting. You know, that's the activity classically of a big pharma company. So, you know, knowing that we're building the right kind of assets that drug companies, big drug companies are going to want to license in, you know, we're very confident in what we're doing, and certainly closing this transaction hopefully in this next quarter gives us, you know, an opportunity to go and really have a good go at that for the first time. So yeah, I couldn't be more excited going into 2020. I think it's the most exciting time for the business that there's been.
Marvellous stuff. Okay, Dan, so if you can summarise in 3 points, if someone is listening right now, likes the sound of the story but are not yet following you on Vox, given those 3 reasons why they should hit that follow button, please.
Yeah, of course. I think the interim announcements demonstrate that our business model is working in terms of being able to run a low operating cost base and supplementing that with revenue. So business model working. I think it's very clear that our technology is working. The assets are going forward, into clinical studies. We're getting good commercial traction on those and that we're able to add to those in terms of the updates that we've made to our pipeline. And then the last would be obviously the proximity to major news events. You know, we've been forced to disclose about the negotiations which we're having with NXP2, and we're really hopeful that we're going to complete a meaningful transaction in the very near term.
Marvellous stuff, Dan. Thanks for that. Wish you a Merry Christmas, and hopefully we'll be catching up in the new year, fella. All right.
I look forward to that. Thanks a lot. All the best.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Nick Lee, Investment Director at Rivervolt Global Opportunities. That's RGO ticker. And Nick, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, good to be here, Justin.
Now, you've been on a few times, but I always like to sort of ask you to give a summary just in case people haven't heard you before, sure. Don't know the company. So take us through. What is Rivervolt Global Opportunities all about, please?
So Rivervolt is really a provider of funding and invests in junior listed companies, principally on AIM, but also on other sort of similar markets around the world. That's the sort of business that we've been doing for a while now, and quite successfully, I would say.
Yeah. And now today, you want to come on and chat about a requisition, and it's in regards to Plutus Power Gen, which is also listed. So before we go into this, can you explain for people not aware of Plutus Power Gen what they're all about, please?
So Plutus Power Gen are involved in the standby power generation space. They were, because they're not anymore, but they were involved in a number of standby power generation sites, and a number of these sites were funded in conjunction with a company called Rockpool. Power is obviously an issue in the UK, so it's actually quite an interesting sector to be in.
Yeah.
And that's sort of why we invested a while ago now. So we've been shareholders for quite a long time.
Yeah. So, and at the moment, what's your thoughts? It's not being run as it could be?
Yeah, I think where we sort of got to is, both Rivervolt and an asset management group, Shelverton Asset Management, are really the only institutional shareholders in Plutus Power Gen. And, we really think the company has sort of lost its way, and therefore we're sort of trying to do something to really protect our investment, but also help other shareholders who are also invested in Plutus Power Gen. And I guess since the beginning of 2018, share price has gone down quite significant, over 90%, but sort of more importantly, in recent months, other certain events have gone on. So for example, the management contracts that they had with Rockpool, they've now lost, and the company is running short of cash, which is sort of pretty clear from the latest accounts that they published. And so we and Shelverton have been trying to have a chat, discussion with the management team probably since about May now, in order to work out how we can get involved and assist and sort of stabilise the company. But we really, really got nowhere over that period. Mm-hmm. So, unfortunately, we're in a position now where the only option, in our view, to sort of save the company is to requisition a general meeting to allow shareholders the opportunity to vote the current board off and replace them with a new board that would principally comprise David Horner, who's the managing director at Shelverton, Nigel Burton, who's quite well known in the AIM market and has got a very relevant experience, and myself. And so if we were to be able to get involved with the company, then we believe that what we would seek to do is to stabilize the position, reduce costs, and also having spoken to Rockpool, we believe that there's a good chance with a change of management that we would be able to get those contracts reinstated, and as I said earlier, that they are the only source of income for the company.
And so explain who Rockpool are again, just for people not aware.
So they're a group that has got involved in funding these sort of power sites, principally using EIS money. So that's the sort of area that they've come from. So I think that, you know, that in our view is the, you know, it's the only, it's the sort of one last chance for shareholders to try and sort of save their investment, really, because you know, without a source of income and without the company being stabilised, we're nervous about what its future could be.
Yeah. And so, I mean, it started going wrong. The regulatory environment changed a little bit, didn't it? Were they diesel powered sites? Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, basically, it has changed, and it's become more difficult. And you know, there's much more of a you know, diesel obviously has gone sort of out of favour. And you're right. Most of the all the sites are actually diesel. Diesel-powered sites, but the sort of current move is to move towards gas sites, which are very attractive, but they cost that much more money to basically put into operation. And I mean, that's the other sort of issue with the company, is that, you know, this has been going on for almost a couple of years now, and there's not really been any progress on actually arranging the funding in order to build out some gas sites, which is obviously the future.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, and your proposal, would they involve these, getting these gas sites going?
Yeah, that's so we would want to, so the sort of the plan would be stabilize the company, reduce costs, get the Rockpool contracts reinstated, so at least the company is in a stable position with some income. And then the next step would be to move forward with seeking funding to build out, you know, new gas sites.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So essentially, you still see this as a viable business at the moment, not in its current form, but you think you could transform it a little bit?
Yeah, we do.
Tweak
it? Yeah, we do. We do. We think that, you know, otherwise we probably wouldn't be, you know, spending the time trying to save it, as it were. We think it's definitely got a future, but it's on a bit of a knife edge. You know, okay. I don't think it's got long, and you know, we need to sort of take sort of fairly strong action here in order to try and, you know, save our investment and that of all the other shareholders.
Yeah. And so, what's the next sort of key date and milestone then?
The general meeting has now been convened for the 10th of January. Yeah. So, you know, we would obviously hope shareholders to, you know, if they're concerned about the future of the company, to make sure that their voice is heard and that they vote either by proxy or by turning up in person at that meeting on the 10th of January.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, marvellous stuff. Excellent, Nick. Well, thanks for that, Fergus. Wish you good luck with that. And
okay.
In the meantime, you know, have a, like I say, happy Christmas and catch up in the new year.
Excellent. All right. Thanks very much, Justin.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five. One, two, three, four. I'm counting. PZ Cousins. Really? Quite a bigger stock. PZC is ticker there. Down 0.4%, 201 pence. At 4, Mobile Streams, up 11.11% at 0.15 pence. At 3, United Oil and Gas, UOG, ticker there, and 3.55 pence, up 2.9%. At 2, Oracle Power, up 9.76% to 1.125 pence. And number 1, most followed companies, Modern Water, PLC. Its price is 1.45 pence, and that's up 16% today. Okay, top five most liked RNSs come from the following companies. At 5, Dan's on the podcast, New Formics half-year report. Amazing how little they spent. I quite like that. You know, it's quite easy to overspend. It's very hard to cut your costs and underspend, you know? And New Formics have done that. They've achieved 4 programs, and they've just lost 130 grand. That's phenomenal for a pharmaceutical startup company, you know, R&D costs. Literally, like I said on the interview, I've seen plenty of companies, pharmaceutical companies, you know, their costs run into millions. And I'm talking not 1 or 2 million, 5 to 10 million, you know. And there's like lost 130 grand. Okay, at, what is it, four transactions in own shares. Metal Tiger is the number for the... But they never, again, put the name on the RNS. At three, Polarin Imaging, new system delivery and installation. Hopefully we get Richard, the CEO, on the podcast very soon. News coming out from them, hopefully very soon, on the Phase 3 results. At two, United Oil and Gas, results of general meeting. That's UOG. Number one, most liked RNS, is N. Condesi Energy. Scott Fletcher is increased his holding to 16.2% from 15%. So he's confident in the company there. That's it for the podcast. Have a nice Christmas, and we'll catch up maybe in between that zombie period between Christmas and the New Year. And if not, have a happy New Year too.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.